Ready? Yeah, great. Great. Okay, today is Sunday, December 19th, 2010. And today and tomorrow, my final Sheirim will be gone 3 weeks. I'll be teaching, but I won't be teaching here. I'll be teaching far away from here, as they say. But Be'ezrat Hashem, we should be Matzliach. Now, just to remind you, last week, we dealt with the shaving, and the shaving is a big issue, and we're going to come back to it again, if not today, next time we meet. It's coming out of the ghetto. You can feel the enlightenment. You can feel the philosophic and the daily mundane challenges that a person faces coming out of the ghetto. You are very blessed today, because you can come out of the ghetto and you have no problem. There's a yeshiva university, there's a Machon Lev, there's a Bar Ilan with what do they call the Kollel, there's Landa College. There's so many ways today to come into the big world and to be able to enjoy the fruits of the positive achievements of Western civilization. You have no problem. The Rav commented once, he said, talking about his own life story, the Rav said, "My children don't understand how difficult it was for me to leave Warsaw, to leave Eastern Europe, to go to Berlin, to go to university, and today they can do it so easily, no problem. Yeshiva University, the same building, till 3 o'clock you're in yeshiva. 3 o'clock on, at least in my time, I don't know what the program is today, 3 o'clock on, you're in college, you're in university." And we have to appreciate the dilemma, the very difficult position in which Reb Shaul Berlin found himself. Okay, now, and last week, getting involved with the shaving, I showed you some inferences and sources, very fascinating. I told David earlier that Hasidim in America already sent me a lot of material on their take on the Reb Aaron and the Lubavitcher Rebbe controversy. So when I go through it, next time we meet, I'll add if there's anything to add. But there's no question that the Hasidic world, the Litvisher world, parted on many topics. And on the topic of shaving, in Hasidic eyes, they view the Litvish yeshivas as shvatzim, chutz l'tchum. And among their problems with the Litvish yeshiva were the fact that everyone shaved. Now I realize, don't ask me about today. Today, you know, Lithuania is not left, everyone has become Hasidish. If Reb Chaim Kanievsky's picture can appear on bottles of wine, and it's called Yayin Skula, that's Reb Chaim Kanievsky, the son-in-law of Rav Elyashiv. Rav Elyashiv was the son-in-law of Rabbi Levin. So you're talking the heart of Litvish Jewry. Reb Chaim Kanievsky is the nephew to the Chazon Ish. It's the title of son. And if we can have bottles floating around of bracha on top of Yayin, Nisim, believe me, the Litvish world has ended. So today, some of you guys have beards. Go into Chevron, you'll see many beards. Go into Panovich, you'll see beards. But that was not the case in pre-World War II Europe. Yes, Mendel?
Where do you find wine like this?
I see you don't read the Israeli newspapers. Get hold of Basheva, and you'll see a full page ad. Get hold of Hashavua. It costs nothing. You'll see a full page ad. Get hold of Makar Rishon, you'll see a full page ad. And if you don't believe in that, they even tell you that Rebbetzin Kanievsky will remember you when she benches left. And I already told you, I don't go into more detail, the Mashkir from Lakewood already claimed it's Geneva, and it's not a simple matter for Litvakin to advertise Skulat. It's not a simple matter. There is Geneva dot here, and Lakewood had a very big problem, which has made the headlines in America, where girls who are not married, looking for a shidduch, were told if you contribute, you'll get a shidduch within a year. and they contributed thousands of dollars, and within a year they had no shidduch, and they came to the mashgiach of Lakewood crying, and he went public. I have to give him credit, he has guts. He went to Reb Matashel Solomon. Kupareya, yeah, I understand, but that was that Rav Kanievsky will daven for you. And he went to Rav Kanievsky, and he was still at vehement. After he spoke to Kanievsky, he told him, you know, what do I do? They give me a list, I look at the list, I pray for Klal Yisrael. But he felt that's not an answer, and for once I agree with the Mashgiach of Lakewood. As you know, I differed very strongly with him on the book on with the Reform Rabbi and the Lakewood Fellow, which he encouraged. I came out very, my feeling was very much against it. There I was the Kanoi, and he was the Mekil. This time around, we're both Kanoim and Mekilim at the same time. Anyway, be it as it may, the Litvische Welt changed dramatically, but what Litva was, and that's what we learned about last week, and I gave you a sideshow, forgetting about the shaving, the whole question of tzitzit, which is just a story unto itself. It would make a fascinating article when the Mir Yeshiva was accused that their students did not wear tzitzit. Now, then at the end of the shiur, we got involved in a major topic. And that, of course, is Cholavakum and Gvinatakum. And these are problems all of us in the modern world have experienced. Today it also translates, as the Tshuva of the Besamim Rosh mentions, it translates to Stam Yenam, because all of you know there's nothing that can be treif in wine, there's nothing that can be treif in milk that we drink. It's governmentally supervised, and as the Besamim Rosh says, even if donkey's milk is good to cure a certain illness, it costs five times as much as regular milk. So no normal person is going to sell donkey's milk as regular milk when it costs them five times as much to produce. Anyway, those problems are real, and you see with the Besamim Rosh, how he quotes Rabbeinu Tam, and this is all fantasy, because we have no trace of Rabbeinu Tam being mekil in Cholavakum and Gevinatakum. Yes, in Stam Yenam, in a certain part of the production, Rabbeinu Tam was Mekil. So what the Besamim Rosh did very ingeniously, he took his kula by Stam Yenam, which I explained last week with stumping on the wine, and I refer you to my classmate's magnum opus, Rabbi Dr. Professor Chaim Soloveitchik, whom my students call Dr. Grach, Dr. Hagon Reb Chaim. And students are very insightful. I mean, Dr. Grach is a perfect description of Chaim Soloveitchik. It's ingenious. So if you take his masterpiece, Yenam, which came out about a year ago, which is really something special, it's beyond words. I can't speak about it now, but I once spoke about it in class, and I left the class with the question, would the Rav be proud of Chaim? And I want to tell you, that question hangs fire, because half the book shows tremendous lamdanut, but the other half is Chachmat Yisrael and his sociological, historic, economic interpretations of Franco-Germany and the wine industry during the Middle Ages. Would the Rav have nachat? You're welcome to think about the question for the next 99 years and see if you can come up with an answer. Aaron Rakefer had nachat, but I had nachat because I can appreciate, obviously, the world of learning I certainly can appreciate. And the world of Chachmat Yisrael, I have a doctorate. Of course, it's not in Talmudics. My doctorate is in Jewish history. But I was exposed to that approach. And I often say, if a student is Misha Milo Kreso, Basa V'yayin, quoting the Raman, Reshman Vav Yoredeya, if you know Shasim Paiskim and you want to go into it with a so-called Chachmat Yisrael approach, if those are your inclinations, I would not discourage you. Anyway, that's a fabulous tshuva. And again, it reflects coming out of the ghetto. You're traveling. You're intermingling. We're going to see all this. Every word I'm saying comes to life in the Besamim Rosh. Ephraim made me very happy when I walked into the room a half hour ago, 40 minutes ago, to set up. So Ephraim told me he was learning the Pitchei Tshuva, and he saw that the Pitchei Tshuva quotes the Besamim Rosh and the Kasada Hasana, his super commentary. Yes, I'm aware of it. And you see that the Besamim Rosh, many took it very seriously. And even those who don't take it as the Rosh, but as Rav Avadya said, as Rav Zevin said, Masha Hashuv, Masha Huama, Lo Misha Amah, etc. You understand? So you see, the Besamim Rosh, Rav Shaul Berlin, cannot be dismissed too easily. Now, I want to pick up where I left off at the end of last week's Shin. This is one of the most famous Tshuvot ever. It's Resh Nun Aleph in the Besamim Rosh. And here, it's beyond words because he puts this into the words of the Rosh. And here you get involved, as I said last week, today we all learn Rambam, we all get excited with the Rambam, and it's hard to believe that they took the Rambam's writings and burned them in public. And yet you all know that the Maimonidean controversy was very intense and lasted well on to 100 years, and the tremendous battle. Some wouldn't even use the Mishnah Torah. Some used the Mishnah Torah, but wouldn't use the first part of the Mishnah Torah. So they, what's his first? Sefer Hamadah, but the first part. Yesodei HaTorah, where he goes into philosophy, at least the first four prakim, people would not use it. Others never touched the Moreh Nevuchim. The Moreh Nevuchim was mamish considered treif, pasul, etc. Now, in the Rosh's time, this controversy was very big, and he was caught up in it, and he came down on the side of the Rashba, where the Rashba issued a cherem that no one is allowed to study Kabbalah or philosophy until they're 25. And you got to remember, what was the lifespan then? The lifespan then was 40, 50, 20. Today we say you can't study Kabbalah till you're 40. Okay? So then it was until you're 25. And the Rosh agreed with the Rambam. So here you're taking someone who you know was anti-philosophy, anti-Moreh Nevuchim. He was not involved in all that Sephardic Jewry was caught up in. He grew up in Franco Germany, and when he finally came to the Sephardic world, he was influenced by the Rashba. I don't have to tell you who the Rashba, these were Gedolei Harishonim. And here you take the Rosh and you get involved in philosophy. Now, the Tshuva is very interesting, and as I started to tell you last week, the Rosh praises the Rambam. And he says, no one knew Aristotle better than the Rambam. And to understand religion, you have to be like the Rambam. You have to be filled with general philosophy. Without that, you will be lost. And he puts this into the words of the Rosh. Okay. But now I want to go one step further. It is amazing here. Tell me, when you come out of the ghetto, what happens? How many of you have grown up in the ghetto? Let me tell you a little true story from my 52 years that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has privileged me to teach Torah. I had a student, 31 years, I taught women as well as men. I had a very bright lady, college student. Father, very well-known rabbi. I can even say to you that many of you know her father. He's not a youngster today. Big Talmud Chacham. And this girl came over to me, and she confided in me. She has real problems of faith. I said, what are you talking about? She said, well, she went out on a date with this fellow in Einstein Medical School. She was perhaps a freshman in Stern College at the time. And on the date, this fellow says to her, how do you know that God exists? how do you know that there was Matan Torah? She said, he shook me up and I'm shaking until today. I didn't know what to answer. So I said to her, wait a minute. You grew up in a home, your father. So my wife knows the family. Gran knows the family. So I asked Gran, I know the rabbi. Tell me about his wife. So my wife tells me about his late wife, that she was a Beis Yaakov girl, loved Beis Yaakov, raised in Beis Yaakov. The father was very broad, the mother was very narrow. In the home, these questions were never asked, never brought up, never spoken about. All right, do you live in a ghetto? Believe me, I don't believe a kid in Meir Sharim or Ger or Gur, as we say in Hebrew, if you go into their chayda, if you walk in Geula, you walk in that area, I don't believe that the teachers are teaching them, how do you answer someone who says to you, how do you know God exists? I can tell you, yours truly was asked that question in front of 600 Air Force people in the biggest Air Force base, which we later gave up down in Sinai. And I was asked that by a fairly high-ranking officer. And in front of 600 people, I responded intuitively. You're asking me if God exists? The very fact that you're asking the question proves that God exists. And suddenly there was a pained silence. I said, let me explain. Why are you asking that question? I said, dogs don't ask that question. Monkeys don't ask that question. Animals don't ask that question. Why are you asking it? Because Vayipach Ba'apav Nishmat Chayim, there's a soul in you. I quoted, Midelenafach, the Zohar, quoted by the Rishonim, God put something into you. A human being quests to do good. He's not happy just living a life of hefkirut. It bothers him. Lev Rishayim Negash, I quoted the prophet. I said, you're seeking, you're searching. That's why you're asking the question. The question is a good question. But the very fact that you're asking it shows you're seeking out divinity. You're seeking out Tselem Elokim. You're seeking out that Tselem that is within you. You want to understand it. Anyway, he accepted the answer very graciously and said that he has to think about it, but he's very moved. I later learned he became a total Baal Tshuva, and people told me I had started the process before that question, but it certainly helped push him along the way. Anyway, be it as it may, excuse me?
The kids in Glu are going to get that question soon. Living in this world again.
No, besides that, let their machanchim worry about it, you understand? There are many approaches. You can go with a philosophic approach, you can go with an emotional approach, you can go with the Marabu Masech Hashem. All right, there are many ways to approach it, but nevertheless, you can't prove it 100%. If you could prove it 100%, I always tell people it wouldn't be emunah. What does emunah mean? Belief. The very definition of belief means it's something that I cannot prove 100%. Okay, anyway, the Rebbe spoke many times. He loved the pasuk, Lev Rishon Nigash. And he spoke many times along the thing that I just mentioned. And Einachinami, a child seeks to be good. It's only life that influences a person at times to become evil. Children, if you see them and you talk with them, you know, a kid of 8, 9, there's such purity. Later in life, we don't know what's going to happen to them. But the purity is there. This is why Chazal say you start studying with the kid Vayikra, Sefer Vayikra, that let the pure children come and learn the purest topic of holiness, of sacrifice, of karbanot, of human existence on the highest level. Okay, now, you come out of the ghetto. Nachum just said it. These questions are thrown at you. For hundreds of years, the Jew in Germany lived in the ghetto. Suddenly he comes out. Our greatest example is Moshe Mendelssohn. You all know that Moshe ben Menachem or Moshe Dessau or Moshe Mendelssohn, whatever name you know him by, came out of the ghetto 1762, won an award for a brilliant essay in German on philosophy, general philosophy, and out of the ghetto, he suddenly is entangled with contemporary philosophy, contemporary theology. Now, one of the most basic issues that comes up is creed versus deed. Creed means belief. It's a word you don't use anymore in English. When I was growing up and you became a Boy Scout, there was what was called the Boy Scout Creed. You had to subscribe to certain ideas, certain commitments that were part of being a Boy Scout. Creed versus deed. And look at the world's religions. What is Catholicism? Catholicism is very big. Protestantism, Germany. What type of religion is that? That's a religion of creed, not of deed. I grew up in a neighborhood that was one-third Italian, one-third Irish, one-third Jewish, the old Bronx. I could watch my neighbors. They went to church on Sunday for 1 hour. Came home from the church, they could do whatever they want. What was Sunday? What were the mitzvot? What were the sacraments? All in all, they had a handful of sacraments. I don't want to go into a Catholic theology now. But you went to Mass and you saw, you participated in the miracle, the transubstantiation, if I'm pronouncing it right, and the wine and the wafer, the blood, the meat. I don't even want to go further. You finished. 1 hour. 1 hour. And it's done. And you come home and you sit down, you take pretzels and beer and you turn on the TV and the football game of the week. And you know, that's a religion of creed. And if you don't believe, you don't inherit the world to come. You are damned eternally. Why do they proselytize? A good Christian will tell you, you know, you're a nice person. I like you. I like Jews. It's a shame you're not going to have a share in the world to come because you don't believe in Jesus. Don't, who is it? The Quakers that convert Jews after their death?
The Mormons
convert Jews after their death. I mean, it's beyond words. They converted the 6 million. They go into hospitals. Jews die. They list them as Mormons. I don't know how they convert someone after their death, but hocus pocus, you can do anything. But you see, what is our religion? Now, this is a very difficult question. Are we deed or are we creed? I have to tell you, I personally come down on the side of deed. Many times, people have said to me, Yitzchak, relax.
It's not either or.
It's a combination. I understand, but I want to explain myself.
The question is, where do you put the
emphasis? Of course.
They also
we'll
have
get there. Very few, but compared to us, in other words, that's what Mendelssohn had a struggle with. You'll see in a minute why I'm going this way. One second. Let me tell you what I mean, that I come down on the side of deed. Let me make myself clear. I'm not such an emeritus to not that. I also know that if you don't say Shema Yisrael, you're not Yotzei. You have to say it with Kavana. And there is basic creed, of course. But what do I mean, deed and not creed? When you deal with Balei Tshuva, people who are seeking, searching. So a lot of times, what we take as so natural, Shabbat, Kashrut, Tarat Mishpacha, we grow up with it. It's natural. My grandchildren would ask me at the age of 2 what toys they can play with on Shabbat and what toys are muktzah. So you see already at the age of 2, a young kid is being educated Shabbat and he lives with this, a certain rhythm our life. We observe Kashrut, it's natural for us. One of the great joys when you come to Israel, you don't have to look at labels. You go into any supermarket, every last product is kosher. That's by bylaws of the supermarket. They want to do business in Israel. You have supermarkets today, giant, mega supermarkets. Not only is every product kosher, but every product has dual hechsher. They won't sell just the rabbanut. The rabbanut with Eidah Haredit, the rabbanut with Degel HaTeira, the rabbanut with Agudat Yisrael, the rabbanut with Machzikei Hadar of Bells. It's just beyond words. how many different hechsherim, but it has to have what they call a super hechsher. So, you see, we grew up with it. I often tell people when they start asking questions, and isn't it difficult, and the prohibitions. I once heard the Rav speak about this, exactly what I'm saying now, that they view everything so negative, not to do this, not to do that. But you see, if someone pinched us, Gili, what do you think of Shabbat? What's our answer? Oh, Shabbat is beautiful. No telephone, no internet. It's a pleasure for me. I go to the Kotel. You meet your students at the Kotel. You meet your friends. We solve all problems of the world at the Kotel. If Netanyahu would dominate my minion, the Ziknei HaKotel, we could have solved all problems already. Believe me, we're smarter than the Ziknei Tzfat, if you know what I'm talking about. Now, but Shabbos, family, good food, davening, learning. Oh, what a Shabbos. The outsider looking in says, "Oy vey, lametet malachet, I can't do this and I can't do that and I have to go to shul and I can't carry where there's no Erev. Oh, what am I getting into?" So I always tell them, you know something? Forget about the raison d'etre, forget about the philosophy. Observe. And you'll find once you start observing, all your questions will disappear. No, Mendel, tell me the most famous story of all that the Rebbe can quote, paraphrasing, start observing, all your questions will disappear. Yitzchak, what am I talking about? Who's the most famous Baal Tshuva in modern day Israel? Uri Zohar. And the story of Uri Zohar is a lesson in V versus Creed.
Steinzelf
became Frum as a little kid.
He grew up from
a child. He already as a teenager was learning around the clock. But so you can't call him the most famous Baal Tshuva. Most people don't even know he's a Baal Tshuva. He made his parents became Frum afterwards. But Uri Zohar was Mr. Entertainment. Movie, TV, when I came in Israel, who was Uri Zohar? Wow, and the movies they made, and Arik Einstein. And then he started seeking and searching, and they brought him to this Englishman, Rabbi Zubman, Zichrono Livracha. And he came to Rabbi Zubman and he said, "I have 101 questions." And he started, and Rabbi Zubman cuts him off and says, "Uri, listen to me. Forget about your questions. Spend the Shabbos in my home. I make one condition, you have to stay in a hotel nearby," which was not far. Rabbi Zubman lived in Shari Chesed, and Uri Zohar doesn't lack for money. There are many hotels around, even at that time, the mid-70s. And he said, "Spend the Shabbos with me. I guarantee you, by the end of Haftalah, you'll have no more questions." And that's exactly what happened. And you know what was the most amazing thing for Uri Zohar? He writes this, I'm quoting him. He wrote his autobiography. He translated it into Russian. It's gone all over the world. Maybe an English translation as well, I'm sure there is. Uri Zohar said, when Rabbi Zuberman walked in Friday night to make Kiddush, his children and grandchildren stood up for him. And he said, "Where I come from, your children and grandchildren have no relationship with you." And when he saw that, that started the journey. Now, so creed indeed is a big question. Tell me, who put down the most famous creed of all for good Jews? The Rambam, Yud Gimel Ikarim, right or wrong? Mendelssohn had a struggle with the Rambam, because he's dealing with Christian theology. And can he accept all? Are they binding? And the Rambam even goes as far to say that if you don't accept the Yud Gimel Ikarim, you're an apikoros, you're a min. No? Do you find this in Shas? Do you find this in the Gemara? Do you find it in the Bavli? Do you find it in the Yerushalmi? The Rambam did this? Perish, the Chelek, Sanhedrin, did it all on his own. Is he correct? Isn't he correct? And I don't have to tell you, the Yud Gimel Ikarim of the Rambam conquered the world. Nu, don't we say Yigdal every morning before davening? What is Yigdal? Can anyone tell me? Yud Gimel Ikarim? At the end of davening, if you're a good Jew and have time, don't you say in every sitter at the end of davening you have the Yud Gimel Ikarim Anim Mamin Be'emunah Shleima, etc., etc.? No, this is the Rambam. These are the Yud Gimel Ikarim. Wow, what the Rambam did, and to call you an Apikoros if you don't accept it. Now, I don't have to tell you. From the time the Rambam wrote the Yud Gimel Ikarim, and certainly since the time the Jews came out of the ghetto in modernity, endless warfare has gone on over the Yud Gimel Ikarim. As a matter of fact, the latest salvo was fired by a student who studied with Rakefet right at the end of the hall, and the classroom that faces Chorev High School for Girls, the last classroom, the big room at the end of the hall on this side, I can show you exactly where the young Melech Mark Shapiro sat. And I see, Mendel, you saw his volume, Yitz, don't you have it? And he came out with a volume and it caused a tremendous storm. And of course he showed that in every one of the Karim of the Rambam there's Machlokes Rishonim and there are different impressions and different opinions, and is it binding and isn't it binding, and this is Mark's book, which started a whole genre of literature on this very topic in the year 2011. Now, this problem is with us. It's not going to disappear. It's not going to go away. We have to face the world. We have to be intelligible. We have to be able to explain our religion. We have to be able to explain our belief. I can tell you that probably one of the reasons I'm sitting here, Admat HaKodesh, and knew and was smart enough to give up America 42 years ago, probably has to do with Ani Mamin Be'emun Shleima Be'Viat HaMashiach V'Apapishin Yit Mameya Ani Machakela B'Chol Yom She'Yavo. And I think I've told the story, I put it into writing in my new book, when I was in Bnei Akiva. So Saturday night, occasionally we went from the Bronx to Brooklyn. That was a tremendous trip in those days. By subway, we left money in the Ken when we met during the week and on the subway. And in Brooklyn, we had a kumsitz, and in the Young Israel of Crown Heights, and we would sit around flashlights, making believe we're in Israel, and singing songs like a bonfire. And in the middle of singing Ani Mamin, a young lady walked out crying. And I was an inquisitive kid. I wanted to know, that lady lives right up the street from us in Beit Vagan today, married to a big Talmid Chacham. And I wanted to know why she was crying. And they told me that she is a survivor. Her father was the gabbai for Rabbi Kanatovsky in the Young Israel. And she learned after the Holocaust that her two older sisters went into the crematoriums, went into the gas chambers, I should say, before the crematoriums, singing Ani Ma'amin. So to hear a story like that, it purifies you. It changes you. It ennobles you. It uplifts you. My dear students, these are Ikari Amuna. Do we have to believe in all of them? Do we have a right to have Ikari Amuna? And here, suddenly, and you have to see it inside to appreciate it, after praising the Rambam, that who knew so much of philosophy, the Besamim Rosh, so-called, the Rosh, critically, angrily attacks the Rambam. Who gave him permission? How did he have a right? Who told him to write it up? Who told him to declare anyone who doesn't believe in Apikoros? It's not in the Gemara. And he comes out so critically, so caustically, so stridently against the Rambam, Maimonides. Matan, hard to believe, but you know what's happening here? It's Mendelssohn. It's the big world challenging the Jew. Mendelssohn had to restate belief. Read Yerushalayim. Mendelssohn had to declare, we are a nation of deed, not of creed. Mendelssohn had to answer the non-Jews. You can see that.
Did he become an apostate?
No, chas v'chalila. Mendelssohn remained a frum Jew.
His grandsons,
it's a different story, but Mendelssohn remained a frum Jew, but he struggled. This is the struggle. You see it reflected. Now, I'm going to show you, there's literally genius here, but in a second, we have to get to it. Yes.
It's not the Gemara, it's straight out of the Mishnah.
But on what, how many Karm does the Mishnah say that on?
Two or three.
That exactly. No, you, did you go through Mark Shapiro's volume? Say that, say Fikar, I'm aware. This is the greatness of Mark Shapiro's volume. He gives you all the sources and all the machloket. But how does he come up with Yud Gimel? That's what he's going crazy on. And how does he put so much stress on creed? And you hear the echo of the deeds. And this is a legitimate question. But you see the time framework, how this is happening. This is genius.
So this is all in the Vaishnava?
Yeah. It's a very long tshuva. You see how many pages I'm holding in front of me here. It's a very long tshuva. And it's he goes back and forth.
But this, nobody's ever translated this into English?
No.
This could be a doctor.
I told you that 2-3 months ago when I started. Halavai, someone should be listening and do a doctorate. Halavai.
Would that be such a great difficulty?
You need a son who's a Talmud Chacham and has insight into the era. So you need, it has to be someone like Chaim, but it has to be in this period. It's what Bernie Landon, Dr. Landon, Zeichel Tzadik Levracha, when he assigned the topic Bernard Revel to me, so he says to me, we've been looking for someone like you. So I said, what do you mean? He told me, you're a Rosh Yeshiva, but you're broad. We need someone who can put it together. And I got to tell you, Dr. Landon was not off. He gave me a challenge that I hope I met at least partially. You follow? And I can go on and tell you stories. I mean, what went on with the doctorate and the research, but you had to know both. If you didn't appreciate Rabbi Revel's learning, you couldn't start to understand Rabbi Revel. Understand? I can tell you. You want to hear a story, gentlemen? I'm recording a story. Kalavai, someone should listen to me and record this in a doctorate beyond. Remember of Shmuel Lezer Volk? So Rav Shmuel Lezer Volk was a Telze Idui. And he had to get out of Europe. Hitler was coming. He was not married yet. So Revel got him out. There was no room from the yeshiva. He went to Baltimore. I believe he taught in Chafetz Chaim. A year or two later, there's an opening in yeshiva for a Rosh Yeshiva. He brings Rav Volk to Reitz. This has to be about 39. Okay? I have the exact date in my book. But this I don't have. Rabbi Volk told me this. With no, you know, Meseich Lefitumo. So he says, Rebbe wanted to see Mativo Shalubazen. What does Shmuel Lezer Volk know? So he came in and sat in the shir. The middle of the shir, he starts arguing with Rav Volk about a Tosfot. And Volk shoots back at him. Tosfot asks this very question, a different Mesechta, and gives him the exact answer, the exact words of Tosfot. And Rebel says, Efenuf de Gemara, open up, we'll take a look. They bring in from the library, remember the way it was, the Gottesman library, they bring in the Masechet they need, they open it up, Rav Volk was right, Rebel started to cry, and he said, I knew every line in Tosfot by heart, and the responsibility of running yeshiva and yeshiva college is destroying my learning. You follow? So, this is what we're dealing with, you understand? The stories are legendary. But Rav Volk never opened up to the big world. Rabbi Revel had a doctorate in the first doctorate out of dropsy. But anyway, coming back here, it's amazing how he is critical of the Rambam, who we praised a minute earlier. Watch. You go through this tshuva, green light, red light, green light, red light. Green light, before he called the Rambam the greatest Aristotelian, etc. By the way, the Rav said this. He wanted to write about the Rambam and Aristotle in Berlin, and there was no one who could work a thesis like that. There was no one in the field of Aristotle on a level to guide a thesis. And that's how he wound up writing on Hermann Cohn and Hegel, where they had already a fine faculty at the U of Berlin. Then he goes red light. Who asked the Rambam to give Ikarim? Who heard of so many Ikarim? Who said you have to put religion through so many Ikarim? And then he goes a drop further. And here's the green light. He's Melamed Schut on the Rambam. And here too you see the era. Gentlemen, let me ask you a question. You fellas are studying for Smicha. You are the biggest sinners in the world. Every morning you come into the Beis Medrash. There's some fellows here from Torah Shraga. I see some of you guys are up all night, or you're there, I see, with Hashkama, and you're learning. Tell me, what are you learning? Torah Shebaal Peh. Were you allowed to write the Torah Shebaal Peh down? No? Who's a Baal Kore here? No? Nachum. You're a Baal Kore. I have one grandson, his brother, little kid. Fabulous Baal Kore. Now, could you imagine this kid wants to show off? He wants people to see how well he knows the Torah. So when he layens, instead of reading from the klaf of the Torah, he looks around, look at me, I know it all by heart, and he's leaning by heart. Tell me, Menachem, is he doing a good thing, or is he a sinner?
No,
he's a sinner. Devarim shebichtav yatar Hashem lomer b'apeh, the sugyin gittin daf samet. Devarim shebapeh yatar Hashem l'katvan. And you, right or wrong? And I've given many lectures. Why, if you recall my lectures of 4 or 5 years ago, I spent the whole year, why HaKadosh Baruch Hu was so makpid that there should be a Torah Shebaal Peh. There's reasons for it. We have a living tradition. If you don't have a Rebbe, you can't be a good Jew. Period. That goes for Litvak, it goes for Chassid. And by the way, I'm absolutely right, because you have the Luyim, who are autodidactic, they're always a little bit off the beaten path. You need a Rebbe, a Rebbe, a Rebbe, whatever. But you have that living tradition. Anyway, be it as it may, you guys open a Gemara. It's written down, Torah Shebaal Peh. Art Scroll, are they, why you light Orthodox, or are they right-wing, good Brooklyn Borough Park Jews? What do you have to say about Art Scroll? And wow, they go and they publish the whole Shas in English. No, who raises this question? The Gemara in Gittin, the Gemara in Sanhedrin, the Gemara in Gittin Daf Samech, and Sanhedrin Daf Pechet, and you all know the Rambam in Hasakdama, the Mishneh Torah, Eid Lasot Lashem Chefeilu Togla Techa. Right, the Gemara in Gittin, that at times to save the Torah, we abolished the Torah. No one had 40 years to study with a Rebbe anymore. In order, you follow me, Gili? In order to master Torah Shebaal Peh, you needed 40 years. I'm not letting David Pardo go. This is his second year with me. He has 38 more years to study with me. Because I have what to give him. If I didn't have what to give him, it's a different story. But I have enough to give him 38 years without repeating a Sheyur. Okay. Eight less up, so we wrote it down, right or wrong. And this is the cheta for, by the way, even when they wrote the Gemara down, it may very well be that they wrote it down in an esoteric fashion. You know what the word esoteric means? A secretive fashion. Besodot. So you should need a Rebbe. You have to have a Rebbe who teaches you the Gemara. Without getting started with a Rebbe, you will never master the Gemara on your own. You can use a Steinsaltz, and you can use an Art Scroll, and you can use a Sanchino, but you need a Rebbe. And this is what the Besom Rosh says about the Rambam, that our era, we're so confused that the Rambam had to write it down to give people guidance. Now, what does it mean, so confused? Gentlemen, where did the Rambam live? Lived in Spain. Grew up in Spain. Of course, he has to run away. He lives in Egypt afterwards. But his formative years are greatly influenced by the golden culture. Jews were out of the ghetto where the Rambam spent his early years. When you're out of the ghetto, you're challenged. You need guidance. Religion falls away. You have the Akedat Yitzchak, Pashat, where he deals with, I believe it's Pashat Toldot, with Chet, Stomu, Gomorrah, or Mayera, I could be, I'm skipping. Anyway, he deals with the Chet of Stomu, Gomorrah. You cannot believe what you read there. You cannot believe it. You think you're reading the New York Times or Yediyot Achronot today. Jews went to prostitutes. People demanded that the rabbis put the prostitutes under rabbinical supervision. They should go to mikveh. You read, there are other sources, Jews stopped putting on tefillin. The minute you interact, the whole concept of tefillin became an allegory. And as I told you, tefillin, you see today, the world goes crazy. They see a Jew putting on tefillin on an airplane in an airport. The whole nation comes to a halt. What's going on? Tefillin? What do you need tefillin? The modern world. What do I need? Animal straps. You see what happens. You come out of the ghetto, the interaction, Torah falls away. So the Besomrim Rosh learns Pshat in the Ikarim that our generation needed it. Really, Maimonides was wrong. Really, he overstated the case. Really, he was too strident. Why do you call people who don't believe in everything an apikores, a min? And you know, I don't have to tell you, the famous Rabbat on God having no corporeal form, right there in Yesodei HaTorah, you see a head-on clash between the Rambam and what you call the Ravid. In Israel, they call him the Rabbat. It took me a long time to learn that when they talk about the Rabbat here, they're talking about the Ravid. But Besomero says the Rambam had no choice. We had to save Torah in our generation. And this is why he's now giving a green light for the Yud Gimel Ikarim. All right, you ready? The atom bomb is about to drop. How much ink has been spilled on what I'm about to say? But the Besom Rosh doesn't let it end here. He has a point to make. Ikarim change. Our lifestyle changes. And he opens up a Pandora's box here. And you know, you have to give him intellectual credit. I just heard a shiur with Reb Aaron Lichtenstein years ago discussing the Rav on Karbonot. And he says the Rav, he feels, can only deal with Karbonot on an intellectual level, because in reality, what was the Beis HaMikdash? A Schlachthaus, a slaughterhouse. He said the slaughterhouse aspect the Rav couldn't deal with. But the intellectual, theoretical level, the Chidushim of Reb Chaim, the analysis of the Rambam, that the Rav could do. Gentlemen, how many of you have brought a carbon recently? A carbon meaning a real animal. I'm not talking about, we all bring carbon in life. That's part of life. No? Karbonot? What do we have today?
The
Beis HaMikdash. What do we have today? Tefillah? and he uses, I mean, this example is very powerful, because since we came out of the ghetto, this question haunts us. It has been debated. I don't have to tell you, the first thing the reform did was get rid of korbanot. What was their word? Primitive. Remember when I read to you from the Pittsburgh platform, 1885? The conservative movement, where they remained from, they said, yes, korbanot, only in the past, not today. V'nakriv lefanecha, they changed shekikrivu lefanecha. And I don't have to tell you, the debate rages. Look into the article on sacrifice in the Encyclopedia Judaica, and you'll see what I wrote about it for the encyclopedia. But this debate rages. Now, chas v'chalila, as religious Jews, we believe in korbanot 1,000,000,000%. Never did the Ramban intimate or even hint in the Mishneh Torah that korbanot will be abolished. The Rambam in his Hakdamah to Sefer Vayikra makes a very important point. Even if we don't understand it entirely today, we will understand it when we have a Beit HaMikdash. On the other hand, the Rambam in Meron Nebuchim gives his entire pshat about korbanot as a compromise with idolatrous practices, and one could conclude from the Rambam philosophically that la'atid lavo, when we won't be surrounded by idolatry, we will not need korbanot. The Rambam does not say it, but many have quoted this in philosophical theological debate in the 20th century. I can only tell you, when I was hit with this question, Bifnei Am V'Eda, and what I answered. It was when the radio still did live interviews in Israel. And here they have me at the studio, has to be in the 70s, not over the phone. Today all interviews are done over the phone. They call you, they interview you, they record you. And here I am with a Reform rabbi, a conservative rabbi. The Reform rabbi was a Lakewood Mir graduate. He's no longer alive, Michael Klein. He was dean of students at Hebrew Union College in Jerusalem. I never met a person with more enmity for Torah Hashem. He came to the studio with 10 tremendous questions on the Torah, trying to show that if you believe in it, you are a primitive cannibal. And here it was, the Krat Tisha B'Av, and he says to me on the radio, "And you, Rabbi Rakefet, you're going to fast on Tisha B'Av. Why? Because the temple was destroyed, and you want the Beis Hamikdash rebuilt? You're going to bring animal sacrifice? You are that primitive?" Then I get Rishut HaTshuvah, the permission to respond, and I quote the Ramban, and you know, when we live it, but I said, I want to tell you one thing that I understand even now without having a Beis HaMikdash. Halavai, we would have animal sacrifice and people would see animals slaughtered and blood. You know what would happen? They would be a lot more careful when they drive. We wouldn't have the carnage that we have on the roads in Israel. I want to tell you, people carried me on their shoulders. You don't know what went on afterwards. I had to hide from all the phone calls I was getting. Yashakayach, Yashakayach. I mean, Rabbi Shalom, thus is Vasketan Man and Levin before Tisha, but that's all that bothers him, is that, well, I'm davening, I'm praying, I'm mourning, we should have animal sacrifice again. But be it as it may, think about what I answered him. There's depth and truth to it. You all know, God forbid, when you're in a battlefield and you see what goes on, if you're a human being, you're never the same again. Many became Balei Chesed, many became Balei Tshuva, some went the other way. but you're not the same again, etc., etc. Now, I don't have to tell you, this question of Kavanot is a direct reflection of the period. Jews come out of the ghetto, Jews come into the big world, Jews are challenged by every Protestant theologian, by every Catholic theologian. Jews are challenged by every Jew who feels he is assimilating and becoming part of Western, wonderful, up-to-date culture. And part of that challenge, how can you still believe in sacrifice? How can you daven with all your heart and soul, b'nei chataeinu galinu me'atzeinu, and plead with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, let us come back home, have a Beis HaMikdash, v'sham navodcha b'yira, and we'll worship again, k'shanim kadmoniyat, and you can feel the challenge. So to summarize, the trip is very long. He goes back and forth. He can't.
There are two different points he has. One was about belief or not belief.
Yeah, he goes on and on.
The other was about kobos.
Yeah, right. He goes on and on, and he shows that even if you're going to put Ikarim down, Ikarim change. Time influences them. And the implication is, look at Kavanot, which we no longer have. Today we have Tefillah. So it could very well be that some of the Ikarim that the Rambam was so strident about could very well be that these Kavanot, Ikarim, are no longer applicable today. You see, he shifts sands on you very brilliantly, and it's all in the mouth of the Rush. These are topics that the Rush never wrote about, that the Rush never thought about, that the Rush was never challenged with. The Jews in Franco-Germany lived in the ghetto. They were not part of the golden age of Spain. Show me the great philosophical treatises that the Franco-German Rishonim wrote.
How about the Russian Toledo?
Exactly. Then, we spoke about that last week, when he gets to Spanish Jewry already, he is a forged individual, a mature individual. He's not able to become a Svardi. He remains an Ashkenazi, and a den of Svardim. I wouldn't say congregation. He had Svardi and Ashkenazi followers all over the world. He was the Rush. His son, Rabbi Yaakov, Baal HaTurim already, is much more Svardi than the father was, because he already was much more influenced on the ground. You know, you take the Rav. The Rav grew up in Eastern Europe. What happened afterwards, he lived in Berlin, he lived in Boston, he visited New York, but the real influence in his life basically is Eastern Europe. He left it. He already was 20, let's see, he left it in 1926, so he already was 23 years old. By that time already, yes, he was exposed to the big world, and he embraced the big world, but the basic gestalt remained Reb Chaim's grandson. He was a Briska. Everything else was an added veneer. And you see it in his grandchildren. Look how many of his grandchildren...
He was a little different than Reb Aaron.
Of course. But he was already different than Reb Aaron Kutler back in Europe. He was different than Reb Aaron Soloveitchik, because Reb Aaron was an American product. I've said that many times. Reb Aaron arrived in America at the age of 13. So he spent some good formative years in Talmudical Academy, in Yeshiva College. That was Reb Aaron. Reb Aaron what?
He was stronger than his...
Reb Aaron was a fighter, his personality. He was an interesting individual, Reb Aaron. He was the nicest, sweetest, most decent, caring human being alive. At the same time, he was strident and would never compromise.
He was fearless.
He was a man of truth. If you want to meet someone like Reb Aharon, he has a son in the old city, Reb Yosef Halevi Soloveitchik. There are many comparisons there. And the Nachum can testify that I tried to calm him down this past Friday night. I didn't get very far. Okay, I didn't get very far.
What did you get excited about?
To go into what he got excited about would take hours. But in a nutshell, he's very upset with the Litvishim world, which he feels has become treacherous to the real Lithuanian tradition. And he uses the words that certain great Rosh Yeshiva in Lithuanian Yeshiva in Israel and in America, Ha'emidu Tselem Behecha. Okay? And those are very, very strong words. And he can prove it. And there is truth to it. There is truth to it. This whole concept of worship, of a Rebbe, of Das Teira, of infallibility, of being better than any other Jew.
Follow Rabbi
Yashu? No, he's not a follower of Rabbi Yashu. Yeah. By far, if you understand this description, you understand Rabbi Yosef Halevi. Listen, there are problems today in the world, and we all understand, we all live with it, but I you don't turn the apple cart over all at once. You have to educate and be an example. Yes, Ephraim?
When, like Sam Rosh says, the current change, we still believe in Moshiach, we still believe that Moshe was the greatest.
Well, I hope so. He doesn't elaborate what he accepts, what he doesn't accept, but you understand already, he's shaking at the rafters, at the poles, at the amudim of Yahatah.
As I understand, when we don't have karbanot, then we daven instead. We're not changing the Ikarim, we're changing the form.
Right. So you are in a state of shock that he implies that the Ikarim, some may not apply. After all, the Pitchei Tshuva quotes him. This is part of the very question. In other words, these words are so off the beaten path, the Rush could have never imagined it, much less spoke it. But in Berlin of the 1780s, the 1790s, these words and these questions and this searching was contagious. You follow? It was very contemporary for him. Got it? Yeah, still don't. In other words, the rush, the problems we have in Yeshiva University today, there are problems there. The problems you have in Lakewood today, in Ponovich today.
I agree with you.
But nevertheless, have you studied Professor Mark Shapiro's book on the Ikarim? He'll show you on most Ikarim, there were always Machlokes Rishayim. Can you call it an Ikar? Can you say you're an Apikoros if you don't believe in it? You understand what I'm saying? So that's what he's saying. Why did the Rambam give us all this creed if we're more deed than creed? Then he learns pshat like you that we need the creed because eit lasot l'Hashem. We live at terrible times when people are being challenged, and if they don't have the creed, they will not remain firm. You follow? He goes back and forth. It's red light, green light, red light, green light. Then he goes into karbanot, and what he's hinting here, and again, he doesn't spell it out. But you walk away thinking, well, this is a good question. Maybe we don't need karbanot. Maybe tefillah will take the place, even be a motto Mashiach. You follow? They're debating it, and this debate goes on until today. This debate goes on until today. That's why they asked Abraham Lichtenstein to speak about it. It was at a memorial, Yom Yerushalayim. There used to be a tradition of having three shayurim in memory of the Rav. It's a whole story why, because Chalamay Pesach, you can't get people together. Everyone is traveling. So they did it Yom Yerushalayim when people don't work in Yerushalayim, and they always were three shirim in memory of the Rav. So this shir I heard via tape was on the Rav and Karbanot. I can see Rabbi Lichtenstein dealing with the whole problem. I deal with it in my article in the Encyclopedia of Judaica. Follow? But this is just amazing. As Yitzchak said, you see here the Besom and Rosh comes to life, the conflict, the era in which he was caught up, the confluence. You know what the word confluence means? Again, it's a fancy word. Where two rivers meet, okay? So you see here learning. He was a Gaon Adir, Rav Shaul Berlin, and modernity. And he's struggling. He's struggling. And you see the reflection of Moshe Mendelssohn. See? Did he know Moshe Mendelssohn? Moshe Mendelssohn was dead already. It's an interesting question. Did he ever meet with him? Did he ever speak with him in learning? It's an interesting question. I don't know if we have any documents about this. But that's what a doctorate means. You have to go through everything available. You have to know German and go back and see what's available from the era and the journals that were published already and see what you can come up with. But one thing for sure, don't make the mistake they did in the YU website. They called my shayur of a week or two ago an analysis of Reb Shaul Berman, not Reb Shaul, Rabbi Shaul Berman instead of Rabbi Shaul Berlin. And Rabbi Shaul Berman was my classmate. True, an analysis of Rabbi Shaul Berman would be very interesting, would fit right into the steam. But it's not for me to speak about that. I'm talking about Rav Shaul Berlin. Yes,
I don't know if you had asked this, but in the last few years, there's been a lot written about how the Rambam is reacting to the Arab thinkers at the time, that they had these Ikarim of their own, so he felt that he had to make Jewish Ikarim to discuss.
This is a constant theme, that a lot of what the Rambam wrote was a reaction to his period. In other words, there's entire doctorates done on the Rambam against the Karaim, Rabbi Yossad Yigon. What you're saying is the Rambam against Mohammedan theology. Could very well be.
The Strauss students from Chicago, they all wrote about how the Rambam, what he really meant, and they're always trying to pick him apart like that.
Rambam called Mohammed a Meshuggah.
And that was censored out. Okay, beside that, the questions hang fire. We can't solve it all. It awaits a doctorate, and even a doctorate couldn't solve it all, but a doctorate could put it into proper context. The next question is unbelievable. You might think it comes from today, and it's exactly modernity and what happens and the breakdown. Gentlemen, I don't know if you're aware, in New York, a big scandal broke. Quoting from the New York newspapers, it's all over the internet. Someone by the name of David Epstein, thank God from what I can gather, not observant, not orthodox, professor at Columbia University in political science, very highly thought of, was just arrested for having a 2 to 3 year sexual relationship with his daughter. Now, first of all, I'm amazed that incest is a crime in New York. I thought everything is permitted. That's the first thing. Secondly, you should know the liberal world is up in arms. What right do they have to arrest him? It was consensual, and his daughter was over 18. Gentlemen, one of the greatest tragedies of coming out of the ghetto has been the total breakdown of sexual behavior and sexual mores. Life out of the ghetto glitters at us and declares there are no restrictions. If you don't harm anyone else, you can do whatever you want. Now, I don't have to tell you, you know it every day, homosexuality. Who would ever dream that rabbis would sign a letter constructed by a student of mine from this kollel, who's active in Chovevei Torah, and 50, 60 rabbis, most of whom are my students or my friends, signed on, making homosexuality normative. Underline the word normative.
Did they make a distinction between the act and the person?
I know what you're saying. The feeling you get out of the document is, the key word is normative. That's the problem. I understand, none of us are out there. Again, you're talking like a liberal who attacks a conservative. right away we're fascist. Chas v'chalila, we make a distinction between the act and the person, and you have to, but to use the word, you have to have rachmanis and tell the person he's doing something wrong and tell him he needs help. Many of them would not agree to that. And believe me, I have suffered because you know that among my students, the most famous Orthodox homosexual happens to be a dear student of mine who sat right here, not in this room, it was a classroom that doesn't exist today, 30 years ago, exactly 30 years ago, 1980-1981. Okay. Everything goes. Consenting adults. Adultery. Now, it's very fascinating. The Torah brought a concept of incest to the world. An uncle, right, can marry a niece. A aunt cannot marry a nephew. I want you to know, in certain states, an uncle cannot marry a niece, even though according to the Torah it's permissible. According to Dina de Malchuta, it is not allowed. Today we know for many reasons incest is very, very harmful, not just for social reasons and family reasons and all that is implied by, God forbid, in one family there being incestual relationships. It's not a normal. Children can't walk freely, it's frightening. But we know physically, genes, blood, chromosomes, when there's too many the same, problems come to the fore. If you want a simple example, you take certain Hasidic dynasties, particularly the Tversky dynasty. Constantly there was intermarriage of cousins. Time after time, first cousins intermarried to keep the yichus and the money in the family. Are you aware of the research that's been done on these Dionysic families? Very high percentage of illness. I myself know of cases, mental illness, blindness, and they explain it biologically, because ultimately the genes become very similar, and you here who are scientists can explain it better than I can, but if you don't have a negative and a positive, you are not a healthy person. If all the genes are the same, negative or positive, and I'm saying it, I'm sure, in a very simplistic fashion, and I ask all the scientists listening across the world, don't bother correcting me, because we just want to make the point that incest is forbidden, and it could be for many reasons. It's the greatest gift God gave us, that mothers can raise sons, that fathers can raise daughters, that children can walk and not fear that they're going to be utilized sexually. And we all know the terrible, terrible problems that the Enlightenment brought upon us, where you come 200 years after the Jews left the ghetto, 350 years, where everything goes. Consensual adults, 18 or over, they know what they're doing, etc. Now, coming back to halacha, but it's very fascinating that a nephew cannot marry an aunt, but an uncle can marry his niece. Can anyone give me the greatest example of this happening in the last century? A person that... Who? The Chomolevitz, which is a fabulous example, where Dr. Leibowitz, although she insisted on being called Nechama, one of the greatest people I was privileged to know, married her uncle. She told me, I can tell you, she told me, the world thinks I married him to take care of him. He was older, later he was blind. She said, I married him because I loved him. When I read her biography, the Hebrew biography, two came out, a Hebrew one and an English one. I read the Hebrew one. Fabulous biography. There's one mistake in there. See if you catch it. The author didn't know to differentiate between BMT and Gris Kolel. She thought, the author thought it was the same institution, which is chaval. All she had to do was pick up a phone to me. But she, I guess she doesn't know me, and no one advised her. Check with Rakefet. He knows, you know, about BMT, and he stood at the Brit. He was there at the birth of BMT, and there at the birth of the Kollel. So Nechama married her uncle. When I read the book, I finally learned why she loved her uncle. And I understood already why she said to me, the world makes a mistake. And she seems from the book, I'm not the only one she told that to. Now, here you have an unbelievable question. What's amazing about this tshuva is that this tshuva appears in the Tshuvat HaRash. And here he picked up on it and elaborated and made it much longer. And it may very well be it's a reflection of modernity where sexual standards are breaking down. And he touches upon a problem here that may be the single greatest problem that Halakha has faced since Jews left the ghetto. Gentlemen, you all have learned Masechet Kedushin. Ha'isha niknet b'shlosha derachim, b'kesev, b'shtar, u'b'biyah. What does that mean? So, the first thing you're taught is that it doesn't mean you need all three, either or. Kesev, it's the way David Pardo got married last June. He gave his wife a ring under the chuppah. Gili, have you bought the ring yet?
Not the wedding one.
Not the wedding one. All right. I got the message. You'll be buying it shortly. What does the ring mean? Shabbat kesef ki kesef, right? Haret nukadesh li betabatzu, kedat moshe b'Yisrael.
Kenyan.
Kenyan, you got it. Now, shtar. No one in this room has ever seen a woman married through a shtar. A ktuva is not a shtar. A ktuva is a guarantee that the man gives the woman that he is a decent individual, he will support her, he will work for her, and she can even claim the shirt off his back. How the world of our brothers and sisters who live in a world where the men don't work, the women go to work, how they handled the ketuvah, ask their Rosh Yeshiva. Don't ask me. It was just in the Knesset today. The government met on this very issue. But the normal lifestyle is the man supports the woman, and that's the ketuvah. A shtar would be like a get. A get has to be written l'shma, l'shma, l'shem gerushin. A kedushin has to be written a shtar with kavana for him, for her, to give the shtar, kedushin. We don't do it anymore, it's too hard. We found in the Cairo Geniza fragments of shtar kedushin from ancient Egypt. We don't do it anymore. So you don't say shtar. Ah, what about beer? Let's take Rabbi David Miller's cousin, Ari Goldman. Take his book, My Search for God at Harvard. He has a whole description there of the West Side Jewish Orthodox singles ballpark. Nothing has changed. My grandson's eldest brother spent his Shabbos on the West Side this past summer. And he came back in a state of shock, and he told Rav Parnas that if he lived in America, he'd be wearing a black hat. And this had nothing to do with my coaching him or saying a word. This was a conversation they were having while the rest of us were engaged in a different conversation. So nothing has changed. Tell me, you have beer with a woman? Aren't you married? Don't you need a get? If the woman remarries, aren't the children mamzerim? So you'll say to me, well, they're no Edom. So the Gemara discusses this. But the Gemara says, at the end of Shloshim, there's a Chazaka. Sofim v'niskilim ala Chazaka. So Yerushalmi Kedushim. Chazaka. Ein Adam alse bilato bilatznut. A person doesn't treat his sexual life lightly. They have relations with a woman, it's for the sake of marriage. Hein hein eide yichud, hein hein eide bia, chazaka, 30 days. Now this is a real problem. And this problem haunts us. On the other hand, we know there's a concept of a pilegish. The Gemara Sanhedrin discusses it. A king can have pilakshim. Can a regular person have a pilegish? Samachlokes Rishonim, the Rambam, versus the Ramban and others. What is a pilegish? Does a pilegish create marriage? Well, this is a terrific question. Could be, as Nachum just hinted, that our kavana with a pilegish is not to create marriage. We're living together. But we're not living together in sin. According to the Rishonim, that a hedyot, a non-king, is allowed to have a pilegish. She goes to mikveh, she observes taret mishpacha, she has children, the children are legitimate. But what's the great advantage of a pilegish? She has no ketuvah. The Gemara says that. But that's the great advantage for you, that you don't have to sign a ketuvah. But the great advantage is she will not need a get. Could very well be that she doesn't need a get. Now, this problem becomes multiplied in modern times perhaps 2-3 million times. There is no one who has not been exposed to this problem. Why? On one hand you have pilegish, on the other hand you have marriage. But we have what's called, with coming out of the ghetto, civil marriage. Civil marriage didn't exist before the breakdown of the ghetto. Until the end of the medieval ages, until modernity, every marriage had to be sanctified by religion. Jews got married by rabbis, Protestants, Catholics by their ministers, by their pastors, by their priests, Mohammedans by the imam. Modern times, everyone is talking about civil marriage. Why should the government read what goes on with the encyclopedist and post-encyclopedist? Why should the civil government be interested in marriage? What does it have to do? Why should religion be interested in marriage? What does it have to do with them? You want to get married religiously, that's your choice. But the civil government simply has to know about marriage and divorce and birth in order to run a civilized and a civil community. So you have civil marriage. That's more than pilegish. You're going through the process of getting married. You have a joint bank account. You're known as Mr. and Mrs. Now let's switch over to Russian Jewry. All you had under the communist empire was civil marriage. If people got married religiously, they risked exile to Siberia. You had to be a tzaddik, you had to find the rav, you had to find the sheikh, you had to do it clandestinely, secretly, in the underground. No. Civil marriage is all you had. Then they got divorced, and divorce was very common in the Soviet Union. And the woman remarried, and she never had a get. And from the second marriage came children who later get into Israel, study in Merkaz Harav, study in Mechlala, live in Yehuda V'Shomran. Are they mamzerim? Do you understand this question?
They're not mamzerim.
I'm glad you passed him so quickly. That's wonderful.
But she didn't have a proper marriage.
But it's a lot more than Pilegish. This is the question. You agree with that, Moshe Feinstein? Rabbi Yosef Elio, Henkin, Bappleton, fingernail for fingernail. You come to the United States of America, a reform marriage, a conservative marriage. They didn't get a get. They laughed at the world. The rabbi said you don't need a get. That's only for those fanatical Orthodox. I told you, I have one student who's lower Leinu Amamsa. I told you, I have exactly that case. Where there was no get in a real marriage the first time around for his mother. The kid becomes a Baal Tshuva. It's the Imams, isn't he? Okay. This is a problem that shakes up the halachic world. On this problem, more has been written than any other topic that I know of in modernity. And
more than
the excuse me? What'd you say?
No.
And the machloket here reigned on every continent. I can tell you that I spoke with the Rav about it. The Rav came down on the side of Rav Henkin, not on the side of Rav Moshe. Could you imagine? Problem is real. Yes, yes.
It's fascinating because I heard that his brother, I believe, wanted to claim that even Rav Henkin didn't really mean it.
So I got the Rav to back off that at least he would agree that the children could marry, because marrying is only a lav, whereas for the woman to remarry, it's kares. You follow?
Right.
So she is an eshadish and she can't, but if she did remarry and had children, efshil can be made kozayn by the kinder b'samach on Rav Moshe. Listen, he wasn't a posek. He didn't have to write it out. But talking with Arnie Rothkopf and learning, we went back and forth on the issue. And he told me that he agrees in theory with Rav Henkin. Black and white. Others know it too. I'm evidently not the first one who discussed it. But I discussed it. I lectured on civil marriage in the Kollel for maybe 2 years. It's a major issue. Gentlemen, all this will hang fire. And when I do the tshuva, you will comprehend the introduction. Now, I have a world to give out, but first of all, let me mention, God should give me strength. It has not been an easy day for me today, and in the Modala Kaddish Baruch Hu that I was able to give a share, and I hope you will tell me it was a good share, okay? Pain in my mouth, thank God I have a son-in-law, a dentist. So first I go to shul at my usual time, and three modot evil, three people I know from the shul, died over Friday and Shabbos. Nope. That's one, not good news. Two, I started with Tipul Shorish. How do you say that in English? Root canal. No, let me tell you, I wouldn't wish it on, I don't have any enemies, so what can I say? I'm Sunday Yisrael, all right, Sunday Yisrael. Wow. So it's been a hard day. So I need Allah Kadosh Baruch Hu, and tomorrow Shia is extremely important because I'm going to give you sources that you'll be able to use the rest of your lives, Be'ezrat Hashem, in Chinuch and in the Rabbinate. Very important sources. I'm finishing out the conservative movement, and I want to deal how to deal with the conservative Jew and a reformed Jew, etc.
No.
How to deal? Okay. Tomorrow night, Be'ezrat Hashem, I fly a very long trip. I wind up in Las Vegas Tuesday afternoon. And Wednesday I'll be teaching Torah already in Las Vegas. After a week in Las Vegas, I'm not gambling, take my word for that. Not to gamble. Shliach mitzvah is okay, but not to gamble. No, I was there before. I have a brother there, but this time I'm going to teach Torah. It's going to be a very interesting experience. I think I told you how the Israelis, I'm going to give a shiur in Hebrew for them, and they didn't want a topic on Yahadut. Nothing on Halacha, nothing on Yahadut. So I said to the rabbi, what are we going to speak about? So Malka saved the situation. She said, speak about the Mossad in Russia. Ah, that topic came up. Thank God I can talk about that. And then we go to Hollywood, Florida, spend a week there with Talmidim and lecturing. And then we go to New York, and that Shabbat we're in Dani Schreiber Shul on King's Highway, where I have students as well, Baruch Hashem. So it's going to be quite a trip. 3 weeks I'm gone, and then I pick up exactly where I left off. The sign downstairs gives you the exact dates when we're home again. Be'ezrat Hanatein Le'yov Koach. What did we do today? We finished out the tshuva on philosophy. What a tshuva. Mamish, you look into it, and you see the world before your eyes at that moment in time. Then we gave an introduction to a very famous tshuva of an uncle marrying a nephew marrying his aunt. And we'll see that next time, but I gave an introduction that sets the stage. Now, freebies. This is, first of all, the OU and all their programs in the center of the city. If anyone collects memorabilia, I found this in a bookmark in a book preparing lectures for the Kollel down the line. It's a safe I haven't touched in 32 years. And I found here the Kartis Knisa to the 60th anniversary of the Religious Zionist of America in Israel. Her Excellency Golda Meir is speaking. Here's a fabulous article on Bamishpacha, the latest one about Max Nordau. It's overwhelming. You can use it in teaching, in sermons. Max Nordau, an early Zionist leader, and how he became a Zionist, is married to a Goya. Here's another article on a Gabbai that finds a minion in a cemetery and who he finds. Overwhelming. Here is Rav Amsalan and his Geirut, just wrote an article explaining his position on Geirut. Here is Rabbi Lichtenstein and his position on the letter that you cannot sell to Arabs. Here is my student David Galinkin, the head of the conservative Shechta Seminary here, and his article on why you can sell to Arabs. Here is Rav Ashri. And here is, if anyone didn't get it, Hanukkah to go, unbelievable Divrei Torah, what the Jewish Center does, what YU does. At times, I'm proud to be a YU graduate. So we meet again tomorrow morning at 9:05. Das Vedanya. If anyone wants, I have two more copies of this article. No, I need.